us, producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft at the controls this morning. In this hour show, we have a health topic for you, something that we try to do generally a couple times a year. We'll be talking about skin and skin care, and our guest for the show is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Krista Clinic in Champaign, one of a core of dermatologists. We try to switch off between them and have different people different times of the year, and generally try to do a show addressing winter issues and summer issues because they're a little bit different. Some things are constant and run over the whole year. So in this part of the show, we'll try to talk about some of the basics on skin. And if listeners have questions, you are certainly invited to call. Anytime we have a physician here on the program, I sort of always say, now look, remember, the doctor can't see you. So there is some limit to what we could do here on the program. But we do these shows to add to your store of health knowledge. And we're pleased that so many physicians have given us time to do that. So certainly calls are welcome. And I know the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you again for the invitation.
The thing I think probably we would want to start with is to talk about skin cancer. This is certainly time of year when people are, they're more bare skin going to be exposed. And certainly now for, I don't know how many years, people have been warned about the hazards of sun exposure and have been told how important it is to wear sunscreen. And yet it seems that every year we have people coming up with skin cancer.
Right. And in fact, the numbers are increasing pretty significantly. And really, I don't know, I don't like the name epidemic, but it pretty much is an epidemic of skin cancer. It's increasing in numbers, severity also.
And is the easiest thing that we could do to, well, we, the best thing that we could say to folks is use sunblock when you're out there in the sun. And if we really could get people reliably to do that, you think that actually that would make a difference?
No question that it'd make a big difference. And, you know, really avoidance of sunburn, too much tan, involves not only sunscreen, but also avoidance of the middle of the day sun, that really potent sun that we see anywhere from 10, 11 o'clock till 2, 3. Clothes, hats can play a huge role. You know, I'm sort of a grouchy guy. I look around, I think, don't people wear clothes anymore? You know, what's that? And in fact, there are, yes, for people who have histories of skin cancer and lots of sun issues, you can actually buy clothes that have an SPF rating, mm-hmm, to further protect you. Mm.
Because that, I guess that's something that people need to appreciate, that just if you go outside, you're wearing a T-shirt.
Right.
That provides a little protection, but
right,
not, but it doesn't block all of the harmful rays.
A wet white cotton T-shirt has an SPF of 2, which gives you almost no protection.
So it's almost nothing. So, but if that is indeed something that you're concerned about, and we do, as you say, there's clothing now that you can buy that has that
right
function. How exactly does it work? Something about the weave, or
yeah,
something
it's
about the
number one, it's generally a tighter weave, and mm-hmm, they can still weave them tightly and get some air movement through there. So some of them are nylons. Most of them are not man-made fabrics. There also are some laundry additives that you can throw in with your clothes, which actually have sunscreen that'll stick on your clothes as sort of a fabric softener-like, mm-hmm, addition. I don't push that a lot. I think that's a... That's a step that maybe is a little too much.
So you go out there to buy sunscreen. There are a lot of different products that, yes, are available. And probably the key thing that people wonder is there are numbers on there.
Right.
What number should I get?
Right. To keep from burning, you need a 15 or higher. Okay. So 15, mm-hmm, will really keep you from burning as long as you keep it applied. You don't perspire it off, wash it off in swimming or other outdoor behaviors. So 15 for sure. Number 30 actually helps a little bit more. It's kind of a scientific distinction, and anything over 30 is kind of theoretically not any more use than a number 30. Mm-hmm. Fours and eights and twos just don't give you the protection that you need. So 15 for sure, 30 if you really want to be a zealot. And you will tan despite these. If people say, well, I want to tan, it's like, well, number one, I'm going to disagree with you very mildly, and then I'm going to say, put on the 15, don't burn, and at the end of the summer, you'll have some color on your skin.
All right. And I guess some people they might think, okay, I'm going to do this. I put the stuff on. I go out to do my yard work or whatever it is, yeah, and How often should I reapply?
Probably twice. You know, first thing before you go out, then once again in the middle of the day. That's, I mean, even if I'm at the beach on a vacation and outside, I'll put it on twice. But I also get a little bit agoraphobic. So I, you know, late in the day, I want to stay in during the middle of the day. And then, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock, there's not much ultraviolet B light around after 4 or 5.
Okay.
So you're safe then.
One more thing, and I have some callers here we'll get right to. We now have for a long time been trying to make people aware of the hazards of sun exposure, said wear sunscreen.
Yeah.
Recently, I've been hearing some stuff about some physicians, other people saying, you know, we're going out and we're measuring people's vitamin D.
Right.
And we're finding that people maybe are not getting the amount of vitamin D that they should. And I guess for most people, the main way you get that is from the sun. So now there are some doctors who are saying, well, don't hide from the sun completely. You
right.
need a little exposure to light to get your vitamin D.
Yeah.
Does sunscreen screen out vitamin D?
Actually, complete indoor behavior, as you see with, you know, if you live your life in front of a video display, turn them on, don't go outside. I tell you what, it's very hard to get vitamin D deficient in this country. They put vitamins in our breakfast cereal. They put vitamin D in our milk. They put vitamin D as a supplement in a number of other places, including commercial vitamins. So it's really hard to get vitamin D deficient, number one. Number two, you're going to make vitamin D unless you're really severely photophobic. So you're going to make adequate supplies of vitamin D. The science of the fellow who's the leading proponent of that is suspect, the American Academy of Dermatology. I can, if anybody's interested, I can get you some citations. He is outside the scientific mainstream, and since Watergate was in the news lately, let's just play follow the money and find out that he also is a paid consultant for the tanning bed industry. So, you know, I don't like a lot of paranoia, but I also suspect people who are pushing for more tan.
All right. Our guest, Dr. Lester Farmer, is a dermatologist who works at Christie Clinic. He's here to answer questions about skin, and we have several people ready to go. So we start out here with someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, this is actually kind of a bit more of a winter problem, but it's sort of a year-round one, too. I think, I'm not 100% sure next time I talk to my physician, I'm going to have him look at it, that I have a small patch of psoriasis on a finger.
Sure.
It's sort of the skin grows really fast there and then cracks open and it's got a slight yellowish tinge. Is there anything, I saw in the drugstore that you can buy a lotion for, regular hand cream does not take care of it. I mean, it moisturizes it, but it cracks.
Right.
Any of the over-the-counter stuff that you can get in a drugstore, would that actually help? And can you talk about treatments that can be done? And
right. This is just on one finger, though.
Yeah.
Not elbows, not scalp, not knees.
No, it's just on one finger, but it's really annoying because it breaks open. It breaks open right at the knuckle.
Right. Index finger, dominant hand?
Right hand, index finger, yep.
Yeah. Is it where pen pads hit or not?
Well, it's over two joints.
Okay.
The tip joint, and there is where the pen would sit. Although I don't use a pen all that much,
okay.
The problem one is really that one is just annoying. But the problem one is where the, you know, the big knuckle is because it breaks open there.
Right. Well, you know, I probably as far as treatments, not too many of the non-prescription things are going to help, except one. I'll mention that in a second. It might be when you see your physician, you can get a slightly stronger prescription topical steroid, stronger than the 1% hydrocortisone you get without a prescription. That will help in that localized place. When you crack and split open, NexCare, NexCare, it's a 3M branch, makes a fabulous medication called Skin Crack Care. It looks like a little bottle of nail polish, but actually it's sort of an upgrade super glue with some flexibility to it.
Okay.
And when you crack and fissure, this is just a great, you know, and if you get a little cut or a burn or whatever, if you don't want to seep, it makes it not hurt. It has a little brush applicator. You want to get your own bottle because you don't want to spread fluids to other people. But it'll really help a lot with the pain. And that way you won't, if you're handling tomatoes, carving a pumpkin, whatever you're doing, all those things that get in there and sting, it'll exclude those and it'll help you heal and not hurt so badly.
Okay. Now, what can a dermatologist, I mean, is it possible to make it go away on kind of a
permanent basis?
I think probably not permanent, but several months.
I think you're going to be stuck sort of having to treat this, but it might help to, if you could find out if this is from something that's inadvertently abrading it, but these chronic conditions, you're going to be able to control it and maybe get it better for a few months and have it come back.
Yeah, well, okay.
All right.
Thanks.
All right. Next caller is in Wellington. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling regarding poison ivy.
Sure.
I've had this last couple of years and found it in my flower bed, and I've been finally figured out where it's at, and I've been zealously trying to eradicate it through Roundup. But this year, fortunately, it was pretty cool when I had it, but usually it smites me when it's weather like this. And what's the best thing to get rid of it as quickly as possible?
Obviously, avoidance is the key, just like everything else. Clothes, identifying. The Roundup is fine. Of course, the dead plants still do have the chemical which irritates your skin. So you want to put on some disposable gloves, yank it out, put it somewhere that's not going to contact anybody else. If you got widespread disease, really the only thing that's going to work is systemic steroids, a cortisone shot from your doctor, some prednisone pills, because if you've got localized disease, topical steroid creams and lotions can do you some good. But if you've got really widespread weeping, really miserable disease, systemic steroids are probably the best way to go, even though they've got some attendant side effects. But usually short term, you can do fine.
Okay. So usually I've had just small patches of it, you know, and sometimes I spread them around inadvertently before I realized I had it. So I've basically used the topical creams, but are there, is there something that I could get via the doctor that would be
more
potent than just the over-the-counter stuff?
Right. The over-the-counter is not going to do a whale of a lot of good, although, the calamine and the caladryl and the ivy dry, they're okay if you're not too miserable. They can get you a topical class 1 or 2 topical steroid gel that you can put on top. And you can suggest either Topicort gel or Lidex gel. They're both available generically, too. But, the physician writes those out and you put it on. It might sting a little when you first put it on, but it'll shorten the duration of your misery.
This year I used a combination of hydrogen peroxide and aloe vera plant, and it seemed to dry it up a little faster. But
that's actually a good choice.
Those not too satisfactory all in all either.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
It can give you a week or two of misery. Poison ivy's no fun.
Thanks for the call. So this is actually something that we among us here were discussing a little earlier this summer. There seemed to be a little bit of disagreement about this issue of whether or not, to what extent, you can spread it on yourself. If you get it one place, if you touch that, you can get it. How exactly does that work?
Yeah. Well, I hate to go right at folk myths because I get in trouble. The statement from the people who study this is that once it hits your skin, it binds very quickly and very strongly. So you're not spreading it place to place ever. So what's happening is areas that have had minor applications show up later. So the fluid that's coming out is your own serum. It's not juice from the plant, and it's really, because of that, not transmissible from place to place. So if you rub a leaf, don't do this. On your cheek and on your neck and on your arms and on your tummy. It depends on how much you rub in, how long you rub it, how much pressure. And in fact, it'll show up generally on your face first because your immune system cares more about that and shows up later these other places. The other thing that might give you that impression is, for example, if you've worn gloves in the garden like I've done in the past and then, handled the poison ivy, you put the gloves on in a few days, it doesn't bind so strongly to the gloves that you're not going to be reapplying it to yourself. So it's probably a combination, but really the scientific sort of statement is once it's on you, you don't, really don't spread it elsewhere in yourself. But sure enough, you do show up with new places, which gives you the impression that, oops, I'm spreading it around.
Okay, very good. Let's continue. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. I have kind of a daily skincare question for you. I see a lot of products that have denatured alcohol listed as an ingredient, and I was just curious about how drying that is to the skin.
Denatured alcohol?
Yeah, it's usually listed as either like alcohol but not or SD alcohol 40 or something.
Okay, good.
Did a little bit of research and it turns out that that's denatured alcohol.
No. Well, denatured alcohol is generally, as far as I can, is wood alcohol, which is methanol, which is poisonous, which nobody should or would put on their skin because you can absorb it. It's neurotoxic. It's retinal toxic. So I don't know of anything. This SD alcohol 40... And a lot of the alcohols that you see in skincare products are really, really long chains of carbons hooked together, which have very low absorption, and they're not real metabolically active. They're just a nice moisturizer. And then they make them sit in alcohol water-based solutions. They'll stick an alcohol group on one end. So the irritancy of these products, even though the word alcohol's on them, is extremely, extremely low.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Very good. Let's go on here. The next caller is also in Urbana. This is line number three.
Is that me?
Yes.
All right. I just wanted to share with you a therapy that that I found, that I stumbled upon, no professional recommended. For years, I'd had skin problems in the wintertime with cracking skin, and it would come open and even bleed. And I tried just about every single kind of cream there was. The only thing that any professional ever recommended for me that sort of worked was super glue, to sort of glue the little open places back together so that they could heal naturally. But about 2 years ago, I got a dog. And ever since I've had the dog, I have had none of these skin problems. And the only thing I can figure is that the natural raw lanolin in the dog's coat has served to prevent these recurrences. Now, I might add that I'm kind of lazy, and so even when I was using the creams, I would not reapply them several times during the day, but would only use them once, which is before going to bed at night.
Right.
So part of it's my fault, I guess, but I think that this might be something that you could recommend to some patients if, in fact, it's been documented to work.
I'm unaware of any documentation. Do you have a particularly oily-coated dog like
it
an
is,
Airedale?
Yes. It's a Jack Russell Terrier, and he does have a particularly oily coat, and I think it's an individual difference in his case rather than a general characteristic of the breed.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Well.
Yes, bye.
Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. We're talking here this morning with Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic in Champaign, and we're talking about skin and skincare. And questions, they're certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I'll tell you, while we're getting some other callers lined up here, I want to ask a question I believe someone called in. They said they would be able to listen but wouldn't be able to call and have this question that they had seen something on television showing an ultraviolet picture being taken of someone's face.
Right.
And apparently the idea is that that could help predict in the words of the caller, could predict the future of the skin. And they wanted to know, is that actually something that can be done?
Yeah, that's a very nice question. My favorite quotation today is predictions are difficult, particularly about the future. But the ultraviolet photography is around. It just uses a different wavelength of light to illuminate the skin. You have to have special film, of course, then to have that activate. And in fact, you can just do this with a mirror and a little handheld ultraviolet light.
Hmm.
And it accentuates pigment abnormalities. So somebody like me, and if you look at my face, I don't have any freckles, but if you turn out the lights and you use an ultraviolet light and a mirror, you can see lots and lots of freckling and pigmentary blotching. And that says there's been a lot of prior sun exposure. And even though, and of course, somebody with freckles that you see under room light, it really accentuates that. And then you say, well, look, this is old photo damage with pigment cell increase. So you're worried then that in the light of all that sun exposure that you might need to do some more therapeutic rejuvenation to prevent skin cancer.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean, though, that that person is going to go on and develop skin cancer.
No, no. But one of the nice things you can do is you can actually make those people look better if you use a combination of so-called bleaching creams and some retinoids like Retin-A, and their skin can look younger, fresher, fluffier, and we presume make them less likely to get skin cancer. But there's a big, you know, there's a step in there as far as the presumed word.
Mm-hmm. Next, let's talk with someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I guess I won't ask you about palm reading then.
Thanks. I'm not an expert.
Okay. This is a real simple question, but how often should one go in just for a mole check?
Oh, great question. And unfortunately, it's like, you know, asking an economist about interest rates. It all depends. There are people who have a family history of skin cancer, particularly this, you know, a melanoma or one of the other severe forms, and they need to go more frequently. There are people with lots of unusual looking moles. They need to go more frequently. If you've already had a melanoma, you need to go more frequently. And I'm unaware of any real frank guidelines. You know, I do get people to come see me that say, well, I'm 50. It's time for my first colonoscopy, and I'd like to have a baseline skin exam, and that's appropriate. And basically, if you don't see much of any clinical consequence at that point, you have to ask people to do their own skin exams and show their lesions to maybe their primary care physician, come back every 2-3 years. But I do have patients that I see every 3 months because they've had a couple melanomas already. They've got, you know, 150 funny-looking moles, and they just need a lot of screening. So across-the-board population depends on your pigment system. It depends on your lifestyle. Depends on your family history. But certainly a good baseline exam by somebody who knows what they're doing, and plenty of primary care physicians have a good eye for determining these lesions. And how's that? That's a complete non-answer. Ask me another question. I'll try to be more specific.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Well, I hopefully that's a good general guideline. I guess you did touch on something that I was wondering about. You said, you know, if you have this person who wants the baseline skin exam and they say, well, maybe I should see the dermatologist. Yeah. Should not a family practice doctor, you're the person you go to have your physical, right. Shouldn't they be able to do it?
You know, it's very physician specific, because some people have good eyes and some people don't at discerning, oh, this is okay and that's not okay. And the vast majority of my primary care doctors have a really good eye. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once in a while you see the sad case where somebody comes in from the hills of Kentucky and they say, I've been showing my doctor this over and over and over again. And you say, well, dang, that's a melanoma.
For the untrained person, for those of us who just might be looking at ourselves, right. Looking right. At our kids, looking at our partner, you know, whatever. Right. What is it that one looks for?
There are three main kinds of skin cancer, and melanomas are the ones that do the most damage as far as being potentially fatal. So we'll talk about those first. Those are arise from pigment cells. So they're generally pigmented lesions. The high, you know, 97% of them, 98% of them have a significant amount of pigment. So they're generally the size of a pencil eraser or bigger. So that's a guideline. That's 6 millimeters. They have irregular margins. They have really significantly irregularly speckled or dark multiple hues of color. They're asymmetric, and they've got sort of notches and marks in their borders. So that's the general ABCD guideline. And those are available on the website for the American Cancer Society, American Academy of Dermatology. Lots and lots of clinical pictures. The problem is there's a confounder out there called the seborrheic keratosis, and they are common as can be. They have all those criteria. They're big, they're irregular, they're dark, they're pigmented. But they also have lots of warty keratin surface on them. So I look at them and dismiss them, but the patients don't know that, and it's not fair to expect them to know that. Our owner's manual that comes with our body isn't really specific enough to say, oh, don't worry about those. Uh-huh. So they come in and we have to sort through them. But it's the ABCD are really good guidelines.
Okay. We're at our midpoint here already. We've got a lot of other callers, and we'll just keep going. If you have questions for our guest, Dr. Lester Farner, he's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic. You give us a call. We'll see how many people we can get in. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is Champaign, listener here, line number two.
Hello, doctor. I'm just wondering, what is the cause of the increase in skin cancers? Is it a thinning of the ozone layer or global warming or people just exposing themselves more?
I think not global warming. Certainly the ozone layer has played a huge role in the epidemic down in Australia, because the ozone layer is much thinner over the southern hemisphere than over the northern. I don't understand the science of why. Fortunately, apparently that's coming back. The ozone layer is coming back.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it is recreational. People spend a lot more time outdoors now than they used to. Used to be, you know, more in stuck inside in factories and doing all their work indoors, and now people have more recreation time, and people get more sun exposure younger. Although some of it is that people live longer, and some of the skin cancer increases is in older people.
It's not because people are exposing more skin?
Oh, sure, it's that too.
That seems sort of silly to say. I mean, maybe people are wearing T-shirts and shorts more, but maybe they are.
I tell you, if you look at a picture of a 1930s farm family from East Central Illinois, they're wearing bib overalls, they're wearing flannel shirts, they're wearing hats, because that actually makes you cooler to actually have clothing on, because then the moisture evaporates off the clothing. If you just let it sit in your skin in one layer, it makes you hotter. But we can avoid that. If we get too hot, we've gotten out. We can run into an air-conditioned house, go back outside, and get hot again.
Hmm. Okay. Next is line number three. This is someone on a cell phone. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I wanted to talk about two things if I could. I'm going back to the mole thing. I'm of, you know, Northern European extraction, fair skin, blonde hair, burn easily, and I also have lots and lots of moles. Some of them stick up, most of them don't. Some people call them freckles, but I think they're dark enough that they're moles. We're talking about when you start having them. I know that I've seen where people can take baseline photographs. Is that anything that you do on a regular basis?
Good. That's a fabulous question. And I'm going to answer the previous caller's question again, because I was so vague about that. You know, we don't do this in this country, but it seemed as though everybody in Champaign-Urbana should have a skin screening, but there's no easy way to do it. Because there aren't enough dermatologists, there aren't enough doctors. It'd be nice to sort of take over the armory for a couple weeks and run everything ready through real fast. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you asked another question about moles that stick up and taking photographs. Okay, very good. It's nothing I do routinely. I do send some patients to different places to have it done. There are a couple issues, there are a couple reasons I don't. I had somebody challenged me once in the office. I said, well, why do I want to take a picture of a bunch of moles that are changing? If they're really changing, let's cut them off and send them to the pathologist, because documenting them photographically and watching the changes seems more like an exercise of providing fodder for my attorney colleagues than, you know. But there are families in which there are people with tremendous numbers of moles and unusual appearing moles that have irregular color. They're really not malignant, but you try to keep track of them. And if you have two family members who've had a melanoma and you have you know, this 100 or 200 mole kind of picture on your skin, your rate of melanoma is extremely high. So I do send those people for photography sometimes. And sometimes we just start cutting off a lot of moles as a preventative. Now, Holland, the Netherlands, their skin cancer screening people just dropped the photography. And I don't know exactly why they did. I think they decided it simply wasn't cost effective. And they probably ended up with the problems that we all anticipate. How in the world do you archive all these photos? Who do they belong to?
Well, they're going to have to be computer analyzed, because, right. I mean, there's so many of them. How would you got photographs A and B 10 years apart, and
right.
Well, both of them look like Dalmatians, so
right.
What?
The people who used to, who really sort of pioneered in this, used to take sets of slides, and then they would project the slides, you know, with the naked person near them, and then turn them around and look at their arm. Now let's look at your back. Now let's look at the back of your leg. And they'd go through that. It was a pretty tedious process, of course. But and you say, well, is that the standard of care? Well, certainly not, but it certainly is a good idea. I do have people bring me their photographs, and we remove all their new or changing lesions.
All right. Well, we'll go on to the next question I have. On my face, I also have some little blood vessels, exposed capillaries. Somebody told me that Preparation H helps with that. What do you think?
Well, you know, insert your own comment about using hemorrhoid cream on a face here. But I'm unaware that Preparation H does that. I've heard that it's a nice moisturizer, quite frankly.
Okay. So,
but if you got the little broken blood vessels, there are laser technologies that shoot those right off and can make them go away.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can justify the expense. But okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank
Bye-bye.
You. And again, we go on to next caller, someone in Chicago. Line four.
Thank you. I understand a couple of years ago in England, they had an apparatus, electronic or device that would be able to detect skin cancer. Is that at all available for testing and use here in this country?
No, it's not, although I don't know that it was available in England, to be honest with you there.
Well, I heard some announcements to the fact that they were like 99% accurate. Going on to the next point, I've also heard about the wonderful capability of dogs in detecting cancer. Have you got a dog out in your clinic?
Sure. No, I don't have a dog in my clinic. I'd like to bring my dog to work because he'd be kind of fun to have around. But yeah, there was some lady who had a dachshund that kept sniffing her mole, and her dermatologist said, no, it's okay. And finally she cut it off because the dog kept sniffing it, and sure enough, it was a skin.
Yeah, I heard that story recently. They've been using it successfully in Florida.
Well, you can imagine how I feel about being replaced by a small dog.
No, but in terms of some home-trained things might be available.
Actually, they're thinking about seeing if there is some chemical which melanomas create, which are not created by normal moles. I'd like to go back to your previous question about the – and anyway, if they could find that a particular chemical that was detectable, you could train a dog or you could get a chemical sniffer.
In terms of the treatment of melanoma, if it's noticed, then you both recommend the surgery or whatever. Are there variations of the treatment, or is it all radical, get it all out? Or like some things, are there such a thing as a partial – or what is the general process?
The best treatment for melanomas is surgical, and the highest cure rate is if you diagnose them early. So changing pigmented lesions deserve to be completely removed. Once the diagnosis is made, there are pretty broad standards, which are basically worldwide promulgated by the World Health Organization, and just about everybody sticks with them.
There was something in the paper yesterday about the myth or wisdom of people's knowledge about cancer and
sure.
other things.
Yes, I read that.
Yeah, and to the extent when people think of testing for biopsy and that, they're concerned about something spreading.
Correct.
What is the actual fact on that?
Europeans actually did a study of this where some melanomas were removed entirely at first visit, and the others were sliced through as part of the diagnostic process to see if it indeed was a melanoma before the whole lesion was removed, with, of course, the folk wisdom thought being that you're going to knock some of those cells loose, they're going to travel around in your body and increase your rate of metastasis, and that was not proven to be true.
Good to hear.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Our next caller is line number one back here in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question about tanning and burning. I had a recent argument with a friend of mine who is also of Northern European descent. He's very pale and burns easily, but he already had a tan, and I said, well, why don't you put on some sunblock before you go out on a 5-mile romp in the outdoors? And he said, well, I'm tanned, so I think my skin is protected from a burn. And I told him how silly I thought that was, you know, that tanning is also skin damage, and it's also going to age your cells and whatever. And he wound up not wearing the sunblock and deciding that the tan would protect him from a burn. Is that actually the case, and is a tan as damaging as a burn?
Great questions, and I'm going to pick you. You win. A tan is, okay, I'm going to put on my grouchy dermatologist hat now. A tan is a pathologic event. You've asked your skin to protect you from something which is bad, which is all that ultraviolet radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to say, listen, everybody's skin colors up a little bit. It's a good world out there. You should play tennis and go outside and jog and do those sorts of things. Truly, a burn is much worse than a tan. And a tan does give you some protection against further burn, but for goodness sake, you were absolutely right. Put on your sunscreen before you go outside on a run, because you can sure enough peel right on top of a tan and you can burn.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. Continued UV exposure just will continue to thin your skin, age it, brown it up, give you broken blood vessels. It'll bruise earlier, easier when you're younger. So,
mm-hmm.
So you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. So we have not confronted it directly, but I would assume that you would also suggest people not go to tanning parlors.
Why? Yes, you're right.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked that you would. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Where's Carrie Nation when you need her with her axe and breaking all the bulbs and stuff like that? But yeah, unfortunately, I mean, it's bad enough around here, but you can go to a tanning bed year-round, and normally we don't have truly year-round sun exposure available around here. So, yeah.
So don't go. Although also there are some places where they sell a kind of a service that I'm not sure I completely understand it, but I guess my way of thinking about it is basically they're spraying something brown on you to make it look like you have a tan.
Right. Yeah.
And you say, now that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. And it's really not so brown, because what happens is that spray gets absorbed in your skin. And then it's metabolized, and it turns sort of this orangish-brown color, which, mm-hmm. Sometimes can fool people if you put it on in small incremental doses. It doesn't provide any sun protection of significant, you know, the way a tan might. So, yes, you can burn with one of those, sprayed-on sorts of tans, or you can even buy cream and put it on yourself. There's a variety of ways to get that on. But that's not a harmful product, so we don't complain about that. If people don't like being their skin color that they were born with, it's okay to put a little of that on.
All right. We go on here. Next is a caller in Altamont, Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. My 14-year-old daughter is under a dermatologist's care for keratosis pilaris.
Sure.
And he's treating it with a 50% urea cream.
Sure. Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to have make much difference in the condition. Is there anything else we could try?
Keratosis pilaris is really a tough one. It's pretty common, cosmetic nuisance. It's little tiny volcano-y kind of reddish bumps, almost pimple-like stuff, and little flat red areas around the little tiny hair follicles in the upper outer arm. Preteens will get it on their cheeks, just in front of their ears. You can get it on thighs and buttocks, areas like that. And it's just kind of disquieting. They have this little rough, irritated surface stuff. The 50% urea should really help with the little rough, sticky-outy volcano stuff. It's devilish hard to get rid of the redness of that. So,
yes, the dermatologist said it's the worst case he's ever seen.
Oh, okay.
And said it's hereditary.
Yes, does tend to run in families. No one's going to win a big prize for working out the genetics of keratosis pilaris, but we figure it's probably runs in families. Autosomal dominant is likely. So, yeah, but there's no sense trying to blame Aunt Louise for it.
But that's the only thing is urea you can use on
that. Oh, no. You can use Retin A and other retinoids. There's Retin A, Differin, and Tazorac, which are increasing in the different
states. Is there an age limitation on the use of some of the drugs?
You don't want to get pregnant if you're using any of the retinoids. But
okay, I didn't know, since she was still underage.
14, no.
When she was smaller with her acne, they wouldn't give her the really strong creams because she was so young.
Yeah. Well, it can be more drying and irritating with more delicate.
Oh, then the keratosis pilaris gives you a problem.
The other thing that works, actually, is microdermabrasion.
Microdermabrasion?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a process of, there are 3 or 4 different ways of doing microdermabrasions. But you can basically use a mechanical device or blowing some little crystals on the skin and vacuuming them off.
Well, we might try that. She's at the age where she's just really embarrassed when she has to wear bikinis or shorts.
Yeah. Microdermabrasion won't help with the red, but it can make her very nice and smooth. It's sort of one of those.
Smooth the skin down for her.
Yeah. Smooth it down. Everybody in a bridal party should have that done.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, let's see where we're going next. Line number 3, Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about my infant. She's 8 months old. And she has this reaction when it's either hot or when she exerts, like if she drinks a bottle very fast. And what happens is that she gets red splotches on only about one quarter of her face. It's always one side of her forehead, and it's around her eye and on the forehead, but again, only on one side. So if her face is a circle, it's like an upper quadrant.
Sure.
The eye is swollen, a little teary, but it doesn't bother her. And then when you put her into a cool environment or get her out of the sun, it goes away, usually about a half an hour, sometimes longer. And we've talked to our doctor. No one really has heard anything like this. We're wondering if you had any insight.
This extends down onto her upper eyelid, too?
Her eyes get a little teary. But no, her eyes get red, I guess, because she rubs them. But no, I wouldn't say the splotches are on her eye. It's just around her forehead and around the eye area, but not on the eyelid. The eyelid is just typically red and a little teary and swollen.
Okay. Does she perspire in those areas?
Not more than the rest of the body.
Okay. Ooh. Well, that's a tough one. And certainly in an 8-month-old, I've got all sorts of funny questions. But she doesn't have sort of one of those reddish birthmarks anywhere on her forehead.
No.
It just turns red when she's grunting, laughing too much, eating fast.
It's usually like if we're in this, if it's like, you know, the hot weather now, like if we're really hot or like, you know, like I said, like if she's really hungry and drinks a bottle incredibly fast and you can see she's straining. So yeah. We think it has to do with like body temperature.
It probably is a thermoregulation thing, and I don't know that it's of any consequence. I'd certainly keep an eye on it and watch what happens as she grows older. There are different, it sounds like vascular. It's not really a hive pattern then. Doesn't get really swollen skin. Itch. Yeah, it's probably some local blood vessel flow stuff, vasodilation. She's otherwise completely normal and healthy and growing up, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I hope, you know, just keep taking her to her good pediatrician. I don't know that you're going to solve this one, and I don't know that it sounds truly pathologic.
When do the kids typically would grow out of the...
Well, this isn't the sort of thing that I normally see and think about, so I don't have an age to tell you when she might grow out of it.
Okay. Thanks for your help.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Krista Clinic, and we're talking about skin care. And again, we'll try to get in as many people here as we can in the time that's left. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll go to Charleston for a caller here on line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. About 12 years ago, I had a wart removed from my forearm. It took the physician about 3 tries to get it. It went away, and it's left kind of a white spot, maybe half the size of a dime. As one, I had thought I saw where they were using a laser to restore some of the skin color. Does that work?
Yes, it can. Is it left with, do you have, besides the diminished pigment, do you have any other look of a scar? It's depressed, it's thin skin?
No, initially it kind of was like hot, kind of a dip in the skin. That hole has come back, it's healed nice and flat. You can't tell anything other than it's kind of this area where the it was... They use the process to get rid of it. You know, that area is there, and it's kind of lighter than the skin.
Okay. Yeah, for localized diminished pigment, there is an ultraviolet light laser available, and the reason the laser is nice is that it shoots out in a relatively small pattern. Usually the spot size is about 2 by 2 centimeters, and ultraviolet light does stimulate pigment cell growth and proliferation. So, sure, a series of laser shots, and that particular laser has no sensation, no feel, doesn't hurt, doesn't anything. The only risk is, oops, you know, you can get a local sunburn. Could help repigment that in.
Will it come back to looking somewhat close to its original color, or is it just kind of your hope and a prayer?
How about this? It's a hope and a prayer with a moderately high likelihood that it'll help. Here's the other problem. With warts, the wart virus can still be detected in your skin. So if you shoot it enough with an ultraviolet light laser, you could re-exacerbate the wart. You could, you know, knock the local immune system down a little bit, and then the wart viral DNA might express it again. We see people who have had warts gone for a year or two, and sure enough, they come back up. So, I mean, I'm not trying to talk you out of having this done if the cosmetic aspect of it bothers you.
Would that be the only downside to it?
That's the only downside.
And how expensive is something like that to have it done?
Oh, you know, fees are somewhere in the $150 to $200 a shot range, and you'd probably need at least 10 shots to do it. So it's fairly expensive.
Okay.
Most people will do that, you know, if they got facial hypopigmentation, or if they got somebody else paying for it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike.
All right, thank you. Next, line number two. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
I'm sorry, is this line two?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I have a friend who's got a two-year-old daughter with dark complexion, and she was wondering about sun exposure and using sunblock and what SPF value it should have. She sends her daughter to daycare, and they send them out in the sun regularly, but just was sort of concerned at, you know, with dark complexion.
Sure.
What kind of care did she need to give her child?
That's a good question. Certainly pigment does protect us from skin cancer, protects us from many of the aspects of photoaging, but it doesn't protect everybody. If you're really quite dark, and we have ratings for skin types, you know, there's type 1, which is always gets a sunburn, and there's type 2, which would be the darkest of skin tones, and then we rate them in between. But if you're a skin type 5 or 6, your risk of getting skin cancer is tremendously low, except in those places where you might have scars which have knocked out your pigment, or maybe your palms and soles, which don't have pigment to start with.
Right.
You know, but even people who are skin type 3s and 4s certainly will darken up with sun exposure and can indeed get a sunburn with prolonged skin sun exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly a number 15 sunscreen is a simple enough thing, inexpensive enough to make sure that they don't burn. Then, you know, you obviously want to keep it out of kids' eyes.
Okay, great. Thanks for your help.
All right. Next, we'll go and talk with somebody in the western Chicago suburbs here, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Doctor, what is the best way of protecting the eye area in the sun? Because all the sunscreens I see...
Right.
Do not apply around the eye area.
You're exactly right. And you don't want to, I mean, obviously, if you're putting this right up by your eye and you start to perspire, or you just inadvertently get a little itch and you touch it in your eye, you're going to sting for quite a while. Two ways. You can use a lip balm or other sort of skin, you know, sunscreen. Sometimes come in little applicator sticks, and you can put a little bit of lip balm around your eyes. Now, there's a problem with that. That's
lip balm?
Lip balm, yeah. Like
chapstick?
Like chapstick with an SPF of 15 or 30. You can paint it around your eyes. Problem is if you're, you know, it's kind of got that waxy petrolatum.
What if you're applying makeup?
Right. That's why I said there are two ways. The other is that sunglasses now come with a UV blocking. And I think that it's probably, I haven't been really good at being proactive about this, but certainly people who wear glasses, it helps to have the ultraviolet block.
Because, I do not.
Well, it can help prevent cataracts, because cataracts are basically a UV.
Well, I do use sunglasses part of the time.
Yeah. Well, sunglasses can keep all that UV light off all your eyelids and around there, and they don't have to be the darkest of the dark, because you can have clear glass sunglasses.
If you just use regular makeup moisturizer and then your base around your eye, you should wear eyeglasses. I mean,
sunglasses.
Sunglasses. Yeah,
which block out the ultraviolet light.
And that would be the only way to protect yourself.
Another way to help would be to wear a hat, you know.
Yeah,
I know. I'll never get Americans to wear hats. I was thinking that Princess Diana's looked so great.
Oh, I used to wear hats in the 50s.
I know. And then they all went away.
Wonderful program.
All right, thank you. And we'll get one more. Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk about some of the risks that I think are associated with some of the products that particularly women sometimes use to lighten their skin, and I will listen offline.
Okay.
Wow. Risks women lighten their skin. There are there are two things that we use to lighten up pigmentation, and I generally use them just in people who've got pigment abnormalities where they've got the blotchiness. The main ingredient of the most is hydroquinone, and you can buy that non-prescription Porcelana Esoterica as the 2% cream. Prescription stuff strength comes in 3% and 4%, and if you use it for short or even relatively long periods of time, you can really have no problem at all. Some people develop cutaneous allergy to that. So you put it on and you have an allergic reaction. It itches, it stings, and you kind of know about it. Long-term use of people who use tons and tons of it, you can actually get some slate grayish increase in pigment. The other thing we combine with the bleaching creams, the hydroquinone, is retinoids like Retin-A and Differin, Tazorac, and those can be a little bit drying and irritating and not a whole lot else.
Okay. Well, there we'll have to leave it. We've gotten all those calls in. We've used the time. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Lester Farner, he's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic in Champaign. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Programs also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. A reminder that today is the last day of our fiscal year. Our funding situation continues to be uncertain, but there is still time for you to help. Mail us a check made out to UIF, Friends of WILL Radio, and it must be postmarked today, however. Please send it to Post Office Box 3429, Champaign, Illinois, 61826, and we thank you very much. That's where we will leave it here for Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be journalist and social commentator James Howard Kunstler. We'll talk with him about his new book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. Kunstler says the days of cheap energy are numbered, and as the end approaches, we're in for epical change. We'll talk with him this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices lower. July wheat, 319¾, down 8¾. September, 330½, down 8. July corn, 210, down 6½. September, 219½, down 6½. December, 230, down 7. March, 238¾, down 6¼. July beans, 650, down 22. August, 654, down 22½. November beans, 663, make that 664, down 25. July meal, 203.80, down 6.